Next speaker, David Holmgren. Best known as the co-originator with Bill Mollison, who's far more known to most of you, but I've known David quite a while, and I'm a member of his mind. He's a great thinker, he's a thoughtful man, and he was putting down these ideas as a student in Tasmania as his honours thesis or something, working with Bill. And he's done a lot of the practical. He's gone out and he's built Meliodora with his wife, Sue Dennett, and their son, Oliver, and shown us that it is possible to do and implement the design principles of permaculture very effectively. As he says here, it's a realistic, attractive and a powerful alternative to dependent consumerism. David is passionate about the philosophical and conceptual foundations for sustainability, and it is written up in his latest book, Permaculture, Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability, a guide to the energy descent period. As I said, David lives in Hepburn Springs, just out of Melbourne, and he's been touring greatly, a lot. Actually, you've been downing up a few miles, haven't you, David? I'm wondering what he's doing there, creating things. A lot more cycling. But I'm sure we're really going to enjoy hearing that the hopeful side, because there is a hopeful side, as Alana McKinnon pointed out, because if we don't face up to this, we have an even more nasty, brutal thing to face, which is accelerating climate change. And so I believe this is really getting us to sharpen our minds on how we can change our behaviour. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Susan. It's a great pleasure to be here, back in my home state, and it's definitely a great pleasure to be doing this tour with Richard Heinberg, who I regard as the most holistic of the peak oil educators in the world today. I suppose I am actually clocking up some miles and reversing a lot of my habit over the last 30 years of focusing on if you like, the do-it-yourself sustainability of living a more simple life directly. And I suppose I've made a calculated choice that I don't want to really be a grumpy old man sitting around and saying, well, only made a half a go at trying to make the changes. Also, I don't really expect that within 5 years, and certainly within 10 years, doing a trip like Richard and I are doing around this country by air will actually be able to be paid for in the way this tour has been. So I think we are at a point of huge change. That change is going to require us to do more than superficial changes and substitutions. It's going to require the deep changes that Richard talked about with the hard problems. I want to first talk about what permaculture is, because it means different things to different people, and it's now defined in the Macquarie Dictionary. It has a huge presence in Australia, almost a household word, much stronger than anywhere else in the world. And there's a lot of credibility that comes with that, but there's also a lot of baggage that everyone thinks they understand what permaculture is. Permaculture is about plants, it's about food, it's about our connection to nature, working relationships with animals, it's about energy and materials, about community, people and economy. But I think it's really a more abstract thing than that, because that's the way permaculture is applied. It's really a design system for sustainable living and land use. So it addresses both the consumption and the production ends of the spectrum and tries to bring those together. It's based on universal ethics and principles, design principles. So although the strategies for applying permaculture solutions are different in the social context, in the climate, in from urban to rural, the principles behind those are universal. Of course, permaculture is also a grassroots and international movement of practitioners, designers and organisations, mostly working without government funding at a small scale, like the local power organisation. And I'd like to particularly acknowledge Pat Dare, who was one of the people behind putting on the 1996 International Conference here in Perth. Permaculture activism in Australia now represents a very small proportion of the total around the world. And I see permaculture as an empowering process for reclaiming our place in nature. We are going to have to do that anyway, so we need ways that do empower us to do that. Just looking back at the history, of course, Permaculture One was published in 1978, when I was 23 years old, and 1978, of course, was a time of huge interest in what we might broadly call sustainable alternatives. Energy alternatives, alternative ways of living, and this was really from the grassroots right through to the policy area. There was a huge number of publishers approached myself and Bill Mollison to publish this book. I really see that as part of the first wave of environmental solution thinking in modern history in the 1970s. That came on the back of the Club of Rome Limits to Growth Report in 1972, which then almost seemed in the public mind to predict the oil crises of the 1970s. That wave of environmentalism I date coming to an end, really, at least in the Australian context, as 1982. The Thatcherite, Reaganite revolution, oil prices going down again, it appeared somehow the limits to growth argument had gone away. And a lot of the interest in these things subsided to alternative marginal thinking. By the mid-1980s, the scientific consensus around the greenhouse effect and climate change had really thrown up another fundamental issue of equal scale to the limits of natural resources. It doesn't matter how much resources you've got, if you destroy the climate, you've had it. And this really galvanised a second wave of environmentalism in the late 80s and early 90s. That coincided with the publication of Bill Mollison's Encyclopaedic Designer's Manual in 1988, and a second wave of interest in permaculture activism in Australia. I date the end of that period as being 1992, really the Rio Earth Summit. Again, like the earlier one, many environmental activists thought we're on the threshold of some new dawn. Oil at $11 a barrel, the technology, internet technology revolution taking off, corporate spin doctoring. Again, a lot of these things went on to the back burner. By the late 1990s, I started to sense that a third wave was brewing, and that wave would really be galvanised about these two great crises coming together: real climate change and the peaking of global oil supply. And that coincided with the publication of my book, Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability, in which I am making a serious effort to try and reclaim permaculture as a fundamental design system for dealing with this crisis, rather than some curious lifestyle anomaly. So, standing back from the figures that Richard has given us and looking broadly at energy futures against a context of a timescale stretching back to the beginnings of agriculture up through the Industrial Revolution to the centre of all history, the baby boom. And if we look at energy and resource use, population and resultant pollution, it more or less follows this shape from more or less sustainable pre-industrial cultures up through the what I call the energy mountain of this industrial ascent period, associated with that a culture of modernism where we developed all our current design rules that we have embedded in our thinking, that everything grows, get big or get out, continuous progress. But we've now arrived at a climax, a sort of a postmodern cultural chaos where we're uncertain about the future and about the possibilities for future generations. In thinking of that future, rather than thinking about it in terms of years, perhaps it's more relevant to think in the time scale of the great-grandchildren or the time it takes for an old-growth forest to mature. These are not really such long scales compared with that historical scale. And I see four possible future scenarios that are really based on energy availability. They are not so much choices we make. They are emergent results from net energy availability. The first of those scenarios I call techno-explosion, the stuff that we've been fed from science fiction, the things that I was told when I was a kid that I would have holidays to Mars and my own personal rocket pack, or on a more serious level, Sir Ernest Titterton advising the Australian government in 1950 that by 1980 nuclear power would be too cheap to bother metering. It would be effectively free. Didn't happen. So in spite of the computer revolution, so many of the assumptions about technological advance have actually been faltering for at least 50 years. We have been well aware as a culture that this huge energy base we had, if it was to go up at the rates it's been going up, there would need to be not just a replacement for oil, but something bigger and better. We can't completely discount this possibility that something like this will happen, but it is getting very late in the piece. In this scenario, permaculture would end up in the dustbin of history. The scenario that most people feel comfortable with and is promoted by mainstream environmental organisations and many promoters of green technology, I call green tech stability. The idea that we are going to come down from this unstable state and move out into a plateau of steady state economy working on renewable technologies like, in principle, from a systems point of view, like the pre-industrial sustainable societies, but more or less with all the elements of a complex industrial society retained. From a systems point of view, this scenario actually looks less likely even than the techno explosion. The scenario which I think is the most likely in some form or other, I call Earth stewardship. Not really to romanticise it, but to emphasise that in this scenario, the fundamental issues are the rebuilding of the capacity of soil, our water systems, forests, in other words, the renewable resources that sustain people through the ages. That those will be more important than green technology. So if we think of the photovoltaic panel as the icon or the symbol of the green tech stability scenario, then I think we can think of the tree as the symbol of the Earth stewardship scenario. The interesting thing is that Earth stewardship for a very long time into the future is effectively a constant change scenario, which is exactly what we have become used to. We are a change culture. Whereas the green tech stability is actually a very foreign state. It's the idea that everything is going to move onto some steady state. Of course, there's a fourth scenario, which is a bit dark to see, and I think that reflects the fact that it is all in the mists in front of us. We don't really understand very well what are the possible models, but it's definitely, I believe, a significant possibility. Collapse at what order? From worse than the Great Depression, but continuous? The end of the Roman Empire? No, I actually think the end of the Roman Empire was more of the Earth stewardship scenario, a gentle decline. Perhaps collapse is more like the end of the Minoan civilization, but just on a global scale. So I place permaculture as really being the creative, designed response towards the Earth stewardship scenario. That's the one that permaculture strategies, but most fundamentally the thinking behind permaculture, is most adapted to. In the early stages, the strategies and the technologies and the policies that are appropriate for the green tech stability scenario are very similar and complementary to those adapted to the Earth stewardship scenario. It's just that over time they separate fairly dramatically. So, how will we cope with the energy descent future? I certainly think we're looking at it in some form or other. This is a photo I took in North Carolina. An Amish gentleman going along in his beautifully made coach in front of the car yard selling huge powerful SUVs. But perhaps the more significant thing that people might not think about is that the Amish man is almost certainly a farmer who produces food. And that is perhaps a contrast to the Burger King sign in the background. So permaculture really starts with food for very good reasons. And it starts most directly with trying to rebuild the capacity for the household economy to produce food where people live. Because gardening is the most resource-efficient way to produce food, especially perishable food, and the most environmentally sustainable form of our agriculture which has ever been developed. This can be done almost everywhere. At home, we produce most of our perishable food. Not so extraordinary, and yet in Australia, this is an extremely rare thing. The production of food at home also is more resource efficient, not just in relation to energy. I've been arguing recently that the urban sustainability strategies that suggest a reduction in use of water at home are completely misguided. If that water is used to produce food, it is far less water than is used in agriculture. At home, we use about 20 litres of water per dollar of value of produce. The Australian average is over 100 litres per dollar of value. Sue's tiny two-goat dairy and the cheese, yogurt and milk that comes from that, I tried to do an evaluation of how much water is used in that whole system. I came up with a figure of 2 litres per dollar of value. The Australian average is 680. So I am encouraging people to resist water restrictions on home food production. Bit of a spanner in the works for some of the policies. We need to get a lot more holistic at looking at the real numbers of what's going on. Obviously, pouring water onto lawns and pansies, especially somewhere like the West Australian climate, is not a very sensible idea. Permaculture focuses a lot on how we can build and maintain soil fertility using both traditional organic methods like hot composting and innovative ones like worm farming, mulching. In the late 1970s, early 80s, permaculture was so associated with mulching that many people thought permaculture was mulching. This is a very serious and actually a very mysterious process, the whole process of building and maintaining soil fertility. There are no easy answers to it. It is critical in the most minerally depleted country on the planet that as we move back to more localised forms of food, that we get the soil right. Otherwise, we will be looking at nutritional deficiencies that have major impacts on people. Permaculture is equally, as I said, about the consumption side of the equation as the production side. I don't know how many gardeners have had the experience of successfully growing the food at home and then trying to get the family to eat it is actually a bigger problem than producing it. After decades of the fridge and supermarket culture, this is a significant design problem. Making things with children, natural ways of drying food at home, stored food. Had a member of our local community at a discussion night about peak oil said that she talks to people and says, why do you use Coles as your cupboard? Meaning that no one keeps any stores of anything anymore because we have a just-in-time supply system which, with the slightest hiccups, leads to chaos. I think it's a great idea. Why do you use Coles as your cupboard? This cellar full of fruit is actually not ours. It was at a community we visited in Slovenia where they produce all of their own food. It is possible. Permaculture is also about working relationships with animals, both for their yields and ecological services. Permaculture has popularised ideas like the Chuck tractor. It's interesting that we use the mechanical analogy to describe natural functions of animals because we understand machines better than we understand animals. Our milking goats and the little ones do actually end up in the freezer. So there's some realities with working with nature. Permaculture has been strongly associated with tree crops because of their efficient ecological efficiency. Deep-rooted tree crops can more effectively use water and other resources, such as this pistachio crop at the food forest, what I believe is the best permaculture demonstration site in Australia. Using minuscule amounts of water, they actually pay town water rates to water their commercial crops, and their water consumption figures are about one-tenth comparable commercial systems. Fungi, food from recycling biomass, is a huge opportunity in urban areas. Not done much in Australia, in Europe, in Japan, in North America. It's a very popular thing. Permaculture has also been associated strongly with water and nutrient harvesting. We don't think about stormwater as being wastewater. We don't think about human waste as being waste. We see this as very critical to future sustainability. Our urban areas involve huge hard surfaces from roofs to paving that we can collect water from. And of course, grey water reuse. Falk Gunther, a sustainability researcher, I think at Uppsala University in Sweden, has identified that the phosphorus cycle, especially from human waste, is probably the long-term limit on settlement size and settlement density in the low-energy future and will drive the inevitable re-ruralisation of our communities and landscapes. I see that re-ruralisation coming not just in people moving to rural areas, but in fact our suburbs becoming agriculturally productive, which will be the focus of the second part of my presentation. Passive solar design and natural materials have been a strong focus in permaculture, beyond the simple focus on energy efficiency and insulation. It's interesting that our mud brick house apparently, when first evaluated, got a star rating under the Victorian energy efficiency rating of 1.5 stars. It actually virtually has no heating requirement in a climate far colder than anywhere in Western Australia. But it's really the low embodied energy in those mud brick materials which are probably more important. Doesn't require that huge use of natural gas to fire bricks. Of course, retrofitting existing buildings is going to be much more important in the future. We are not going to tear down and rebuild all our energy inefficient buildings. We are going to have to work with them, and creatively doing that is incredibly important. At home, we burn wood for our cooking, our hot water needs. That's about 5 tonnes of wood a year. It comes from sustainably managed native forests that we're involved in managing. That small gas bottle is our two-burner gas cooktop backup. In Australia, we fight against the perception that wood is a primitive and destructive form of energy. I have to tell you that in Europe, wood energy is growing faster than wind, and that's really saying something. This Austrian-designed energy cabin, integrating solar preheating with the latest furnace technology, which is about 90% efficient, that produces zero pollution, complying with all the European clean air standards, burning pellets of waste wood shavings. These are spreading very rapidly in Austria at the moment. They're actually the default form of heating in all new apartment blocks. So we need to get over this idea and get over having been burnt about our unsustainable forestry debacle of the last 30 years and get serious about wood as a sustainable energy source. Frugal transport solutions. Richard already mentioned how we make use of our existing car fleet. I think energy efficiency improvements from the T Model Ford to the current era have roughly doubled energy efficiency. That's all we've achieved. If we take a car and put four people in it, we've quadrupled the energy efficiency of the engine with no investment required. So I see this huge vacant capacity in our current car fleet and a huge social imperative to restart hitchhiking as a socially desirable activity. Of course, the bicycle has a huge place, and I know there's been very strong activism in Western Australia promoting bicycles. Also, we're so used to overpowering everything. Permaculture colleague and designer Darren Doherty, one of his photos of a motorbike prime mover in Vietnam, a 125cc bike pulling a cart carrying a ton of sand. I think we could learn a lot from this. Fuel relative to wages in Vietnam is about 10 times what it costs here. I mentioned wood as a fuel source. Very few people know that the way people got around in Australia in the Second World War and many other countries was with wood gasifiers, a very simple technology that has a modern equivalent in Scandinavia. This wood gasifier powered ute was one from a Finnish wood gasifier car club. There's actually a wood gasifier association that's been started in Victoria by two disgruntled CSIRO scientists, disgruntled with the fact that they work on coal gasification and the government has closed down all the research on wood gasification. Permaculture is very much about creative reuse and recycling. The idea that the pinnacle of recycling is to break a perfectly good glass bottle and to melt it down in a furnace to make new glass bottles is a very primitive idea. A hand basin cabinet made from a metal drum. Fashion clothes made from recycled fabrics. We are not short of materials in affluent societies. We are short of skills to do something with all the materials that exist. Community gardens, city farms, urban agriculture have been a major theme in permaculture activism in Australia and around the world. Over the last 25 years, we've managed to get some support at the policy level for these projects around their social value, around their capacity to connect people, connect children to nature. There's been no basis to argue about their most important function is to help start urban food production, because we haven't had food as part of urban sustainability strategies. As a result of very good work in South Australia and actions by a permaculture mole in the Premier's department, there is now a two-line reference to food in the urban sustainability strategy. I think that's going to change dramatically over the next decade. Fairview Gardens in Santa Barbara is an example of serious urban agriculture. 12 acres of mixed organic production, employing 60 people, totally surrounded by suburban houses, supplying food to the local area. Northey Street City Farm in Brisbane, where we've just been, that hosted our talks over there. And Ceres City Farm, which started in that first wave of environmental thinking in the late 70s, is really one of the icons of the city farms and community gardens movement. There are over 100 city farms and community gardens in the city of Melbourne. Permaculture has also pioneered and popularised new ways of trading and finance. Ethical investment, local currencies such as LETs, community supported agriculture, and woofing, willing workers on organic farms. Now, none of these systems and ideas started in Australia. None of them started actually within the permaculture movement. They were just identified as strongly reflecting permaculture principles and spread as a result. We got community supported agriculture, where people buy in advance from a farmer who supplies their seasonal produce. We got the idea from the west coast of America, but it actually comes from Japan, where it's called Teikei. In Japan, 5.5 million households get their food directly from farmers. And the farmers we spoke to in these Teikei systems said things like, I grow 60 varieties of vegetables. That was their statement of professional competence, not as we'd see in Australia from an Australian farmer, I grow 300 tonnes of potatoes. So these systems actually push production towards diversity, towards more sustainable systems. Ethical investment in Australia before the involvement of permaculture activists in the early 1980s was about not investing in the arms trade. After the involvement of permaculture activists and the setting up of what became Australian Ethical today, the focus shifted towards creating the world we do want, the positive investment. New ways of sharing land, eco-villages and co-housing projects have really been places where it's possible to bring together a lot of these different elements of permaculture strategies that's not possible to fully integrate and bring together without that community level. I think those are very important to the future at multiple levels. Now, how do all of these ideas and actions fit together? They all reflect a set of ethics and design principles in spite of their diversity. We apply those ethics and design principles to seven different domains. The first and most fundamental is land and nature stewardship, gardening, agriculture, forestry, etc. This is also the living source from where we get the design principles in the first place, by a working understanding with nature. And then we apply those equally to our design and use of the built environment, our use of crafts, tools and technology. We can think of this as the infrastructure of permaculture. Many people would recognise these three domains as being permaculture. But there's another four domains that are necessary to a sustainable and just society, and we need to redesign all of those as well. Often these have been called the invisible structures in permaculture teaching. Firstly, our systems of culture and education need redesign. Permaculture design courses are one small example of that. The community participatory arts movement is another example of that. Many different examples that relate to permaculture principles. Our systems of health and spiritual well-being, a whole spectrum of complementary medicine and alternative health. Movements like home birth are the very essence of permaculture design principles of self-reliance and simple natural ways of doing things. I've already mentioned that our systems of finance and economics need not just reform tinkering at the top, which I suggest is actually unlikely to succeed. We need to rebuild parallel systems from the bottom. And lastly, our systems of land tenure, how we own land, our systems of community governance need to be rebuilt as well. And this, of course, links back to the fundamental one, which has really been the structure of all societies, the ownership structure, the decision-making and governance structures, and land and resources. So this is a huge and vast task, and, of course, really overwhelming when we look at it at a whole societal level. But if we recognise that each and every one of us is connected and dependent in some way on each of these domains, and we start to redesign our own life in relation to those, then we gradually weave that process together. I want to break there and hand over to Sue.
Time to stand up again.
Okay, what I want to do now is really, perhaps the more fun part, is really looking at how do all of these ideas relate to how we can transform the most maligned landscape and the home for, in fact, most Australians, and that's really suburbia. There's been a lot said, especially in the peak oil movement, that suburbia is a finished landscape. But that's really come on the back of 30 years of planners regarding it as a dysfunctional landscape. I don't think that's necessarily the case. And I think it's really important that we understand the history and the obstacles that we're facing. But we also need to read the landscape and its resources and sidestep the obstacles and grasp the opportunities. In permaculture, we say we need to turn the problem into the solution. So let's start at the beginning. Suburbia in the 1950s, the typical elements of suburban living were the single income, really about $250 a week in today's money, a housewife and three children, so family size typically, household size typically five, 12 square house on a quarter acre block, 1,000 square metres. And I think that generation were very much house proud and still had the culture of self-reliance and domestic frugality as a result of the experience of the Depression and the Second World War. The veggies, the fruit trees, the chooks, the septic tank actually was part of that self-reliance, and the lawn was really the symbol of the new leisure and wealth. We can think of the consumer icons of cleanliness, leisure and mobility. The Hills Hoist, the Victor lawnmower, which somehow has been transformed into a symbol of drudgery and work. But the lawn, of course, was this great statement, in a way, about not having to be a complete peasant growing food. It was about leisure and relaxation. And, of course, the most important one of all, the symbol of mobility. The foundations for the growth of suburbia, the post-war economic boom of the 50s, was based on cheap and abundant fossil fuel and timber. And of course, Australia was riding on the sheep's back in 1950. Wool was $2.40 a kilo, that's without adjustment for inflation. It's staggering how rich farmers really were then. War service homes and low interest loans, and the public infrastructure for suburban growth, sealed roads, power, water supply and sewerage. Actually, that picture of a sewer being installed In Bicton, where I grew up, I seem to remember in the 1960s, actually the men dug the trench with shovels. So how did this play out in the average street? This is Aussie Street, number 1, 2, 3 and 4. And I want to paint a little scenario of how this developed and how it could develop. The 14 square brick and tile war service home with a porch on the front and the veranda out the back on the quarter acre block. Married couple with no kids in the first house. They've got the shed out the back, of course. Every bloke has to have the shed. And there's the Hills hoist and the garage and the new car. And, of course, there's the chook pen and the veggie garden and some fruit trees and, of course, the lawn and the ornamental garden out the front. At number two, there's a married couple with three kids and, of course, they've got the shed and the Hills hoist, a carport on the side of the house and a car, more extensive veggie garden and fruit trees, a little bit less lawn and the ornamental garden. At number three, there's a married couple that end up with five kids there, and he's actually a mechanic, and he's got a garage down the back and works from home. They've actually got two cars, being a mechanic, and they've got the Hills hoist, but they're not much in the way of gardeners. They've got a sort of fairly minimalist garden. At number four, there's another couple with three kids, and they're actually Italians, I think, and they've got the biggest veggie garden of all and more fruit trees. They've still got the lawn, but they've got a sort of bit of a funny front garden that's all full of olive trees. Anyway, in this, the golden age of suburbia, there's 19 people on this bit of real estate with an amazingly small amount of built area. And if we multiplied the number of people by the area of housing and then looked at the occupancy rate, we would see that, in fact, this was a very active place. I suppose my early environmental awareness was really against the background of this living design. And I came in my early teens to regard this form of living as the most extravagant, resource-consuming way of life that had ever been invented. Of course, I was perfectly correct in that analysis. But by the late 1990s, I was teaching in permaculture design courses that the suburbia of the 50s might be a model of sustainability that we could aspire to. So, how did that develop and eventuate? In the 60s and the 70s was the rising affluence and addition. So at number one in the 60s, they enclosed the back veranda. And at number two, they got a new car. And at number three, they enclosed the back veranda and got a new car. And at number four, they actually got a car for the first time. I didn't point out that they actually didn't have a car at all. To start with. Okay, and then down the back the sewerage was put in and the septic tanks were replaced. Great improvement, where people didn't have to worry about it at all, just flush it away and the authorities take responsibility for it all. Another aspect of self-reliance that was done away with. And of course the curb and channel along the street, which accelerated the storm water away down to the local wetland. And the other environmental improvement, I suppose, was the council planted native trees along what became called the nature strip. Very strange terminology. So, but what's happened here? Actually, the mechanic split. He's left with a floozy, and mum and the five kids are left behind trying to handle the mortgage. Well, they end up leaving and new owners move in who've also got three kids with a new car. And they're really keen on native gardens and they plant stuff all over the place, gum trees and shrubs. And even gum trees and shrubs, native shrubs out the front garden. And build the double garage games room up the back and concrete the driveway. Well, what's happened? The Hills Hoist disappeared. Oh, well, actually the gum tree was, the big gum tree in the backyard was shading it and dumping all the leaves on it, so they got a clothes dryer instead. I don't know what's happened to the Italians, but they've actually given up the fruit trees in the backyard and done a huge addition to the house, and all that's left of the olive grove is one solitary olive in the front. But they have had a raging dispute with the neighbours, and they've now planted a great hedge along the side. So the people count is down to 17 at this stage. So how does this express itself when we look at the wider society? Of course, urban sprawl involved the poor use of public infrastructure. Sewerage systems are really supporting very low densities of population. Car-based transport, loss of agricultural land. The problems were also in terms of dysfunctional economies. Huge unproductive capital investment, enormous amount of society's wealth, basically invested in something that's not really producing anything. Speculative land values, the idea that it just keeps rising in value indefinitely. And the decline of household production, not just food, but also home crafts, maintenance, and other aspects, important aspects of the household economy. Household debt and consumer addiction developing. And the development of what became called dormitory suburbs, where basically, with declining household size and empty houses and streets, lack of community and increased crime. So what are the conventional responses been to these problems? Well, on the planning front, we've had planning regulations to encourage increasing density. Density increase has become virtually a reason for existence for large numbers of the planning profession. All their life, that's what the purpose of their profession has been. And that's been through a whole lot of different instruments. Smaller house blocks, 500 square metres. Dual occupancy, double the monocultural design, fill in every backyard. Perhaps one of the most poorly thought out aspects of this increased density idea. Medium density redevelopment, knock it all down and start again. But the responses have also come in terms of lifestyle. We've had the holidays away, escaping from it. The live-out mobile lifestyle, where people have got it all at home under lock and key, but they're out and about in their cars using other public resources, effectively making our cities increasingly full of people going between buildings under lock and key. Our cities are not really full of people at all, they're full of empty buildings. The renovation obsession, constantly redoing things. And the move to the inner city, apartment living, and the move to country living, creating effectively the super suburb. We've also seen environmental responses to these problems, improved public transport. Well, actually, I don't think that is a picture of Perth's latest... it's actually Basel, Switzerland. But the idea, and of course in this city, there's been very serious improvements since I lived here in the 1960s, when I used to describe Perth as the Los Angeles of Australia in terms of car dependence. Building insulation and energy efficiency. Serious changes. In the cold capitals of Australia, in Canberra, Melbourne, Hobart, in the 1960s, virtually none of the housing stock was insulated to any great degree. Virtually all of it is now. A huge achievement. Unfortunately, energy consumption in that period for heating has actually gone up. Urban green space, water-sensitive urban design, native landscaping for water conservation and biodiversity. So these have been attempts to deal with some of these issues. And how has this sort of really played out back in Aussie Street? Well, we've now got an elderly couple who, of course, don't have any kids at number one. Things are getting fairly tough, and they've really given up the food garden now, and it's returned to an unirrigated mown grass up the back. And in number two, we've got an elderly couple that's moving to a nursing home. And the gum tree out the front isn't looking too good either, actually. It's on the way out, it's dying. At number three, there's the empty nest baby boomers there, and they're retiring to Queensland. Well, at least if this is Melbourne. The gum trees have got pretty huge by this stage. They've sort of covered the whole place. And at number four, a new developer's bought the house, knocked down the garden and the carport, and put a 180 square metre brick veneer in the backyard. Of course, there's the carport and the concreted area virtually paving the whole block, and then the council's made them put in the stormwater detention tank so they don't overload the stormwater system, and the developers put in a nice drip irrigated ornamental garden. And in the front house, there's now a separated working mother with two teenage kids who are pretty much couch potatoes renting there, and the young working couple with no kids in the back. And the people count's down to 11. So we've got this huge increase in built area in infrastructure, and there's actually less people there, and they're actually spending less time there as well. So what do we do if energy, available energy, is actually in decline? This is clearly going to, a falling energy base will change things on many fronts, and it'll expand a lot of the symptoms in terms of services, food supply, water supply over a period of decades. It'll bring a lot of the problems home in all sorts of different forms: terrorism, refugees, recessions. And it'll make current urban design strategies ineffective. But the positives of energy descent are quite substantial, because it'll drive creative adaption and innovation. It'll help overcome obsessions and addictions, and it'll renew community spirit and solidarity. So what are the prospects for suburbia? Is it the end of suburbia or the retrofit? Home-based work, telecommuting, cottage industries, extended families, lodges and shared households. The fertile soils, water supply and infrastructure for urban agriculture. Our Australian cities are capable of producing excess perishable food production, more than they need to consume. There's plenty of evidence that that is possible. The possibility to recycle stormwater and human waste. City farms, CSAs, farmers markets. So let's paint the picture of how this could be happening now, starting now, in Aussie Street. The two houses up for sale in the middle. Number two is completely unmodified, the original 1950s house. Pretty cheap, and a young couple with a baby move in after a bit of inheritance, managing to get a loan to build it, to buy it. And they start immediately modifying things. He's a mad permy gardener, and he starts a home nursery in the carport. And he's got all his stock out along the driveway, actually selling plants. He doesn't actually have a permit for a business from the local council, but he's starting anyway. And they start modifying the garden. They don't have a lot of money, but they put up the chook run and tool shed at the back, and the straw yard, and they start some serious production vegetable garden to actually sell boxes to neighbours and friends. The water tank on the house for rainwater is the first priority. As they get a bit more money, a larger tank to store more water, greenhouse, shade house, etc. Filling the back with more fruit trees with a chook run. And there's the perennials out the front and the two fruit trees on the street verge. And then they do this little modification to the curb and channeling to divert the storm water off the onto the fruit trees. Again, they don't have permission for a tiny little bit of concrete in the curb gutter, which actually diverts the water. But it is actually following the latest in urban stormwater design principles, so it's okay. Okay, well, they're looking over the fence and there's this place next door, and actually a friend of theirs, his parents are moving back. Actually, this is in Melbourne, and they're moving back to Melbourne because their ageing parents are needing care. And so they all move in. The son, who's just come back from time away in Europe, and the parents move into the house next door. And the son's a bit of a tech head and converts the big double garage up the back to a metalworking shop, and they put photovoltaic panels with grid feedback system on the back. The parents have got a bit of money, and they decide to take down the dividing fence and use the big driveway as a common access driveway into both blocks. But the gum trees are really a bit of a problem. They're blocking all the sunlight, stopping solar access. They're using all the water. The soil's pretty impossible to grow things. So they do the logging operation and end up with a big stack of firewood. They do there's some planting up the back, and they get a serious big rainwater tank in and a grey water reed bed that's actually taking the grey water from both houses. And they're pumping that back across mainly to the food production system. And then they do the 12 square eco retrofit, fully passive solar, a few other things, grape pergolas and various bits of landscaping. And they take in a lodger, a boarder, who's actually a young single mum with a baby. Now, at this stage, there's actually nothing happening between the son and the young mother, but you never know what's going to happen there. And anyway, they realise the porch out the front's sort of half falling off, and they turn it into a little attached greenhouse entry space, which actually improves the performance of the old part of the house enormously in terms of winter thermal efficiency. And they've got a fern garden out the back in the shaded place. That there's this cool air source for their cool cupboard inside the house that means they've reduced their refrigeration substantially. And they build this big bread oven out the front because they've got all that wood to burn, of course, and the young people are starting street parties and whatever, so they do that out the front. And there's the little more modest veggie garden. They're not so much into the food production, but then the bloke next door, he actually sort of manages it for them anyway. And then there was a problem with the front garden. Really, the big gum tree on the street was really taking all the water, and mysteriously it died also. Anyway, they planted fruit trees out the front as well, and repeated the stormwater runoff system. And then there was the nut trees down the driveway, but hell, what's happened? The Hills Hoist has made a return. There's been a negotiation. The market gardeners had to concede a small area of lawn because the two mothers want their babies to be able to crawl around on a bit of lawn, so the vegetable production systems had to contract a bit. And the compost bays up the back with the access. Well, the young folks, they don't have much money, but they did see how effective the little attached greenhouse was at improving the thermal performance of the house, so they did one of those as well. The people count's up to 15. But what happens next? Where can this process go? How can this build and grow in some organic way? Well, the elderly couple next door are still hanging on. They don't want to move, but they really need home care help. And the young mother next door, she gets a subsidy from the government for home care to help them, and they donate their backyard to the husband, who's desperate for room to expand his box scheme. So number one, if you like, is ripe for colonisation in a very positive way, and happens pretty early in the piece. If we look at number four, it's a little bit of a harder nut to crack in terms of both the design system and the social profile. Mum's still working flat out, and the teenagers are sort of getting more buried in the computers, and the young couple up the back, they don't seem to want to talk to neighbours at all, and the whole place is covered with concrete. But gee, that stormwater detention system, there's got to be a way of working that as a water recovery system somehow in all that roof area. So maybe that the situation at number four will have to wait for the energy descent scenario to advance a little further. The point of this is really to show that it is possible within the suburban fabric for incremental adaptive change to start now. It's not possible to do that in high density cities, because you have to wait for the whole of society and its structures to agree that we have to change radically what we are doing. And then it's also much more technically difficult to change our high density cities. Our suburbs are actually set up for this possible retrofit, which can start from individuals, from people, from communities building this up. We don't have to wait for governments. Everyone really did understand that permaculture is a subversive process. I think we can see very clearly. We need to kickstart the relocalisation of our communities and economies. I think there's some imperatives to network for inspiration and information, to get producing and support local producers. Food is really the most central issue, not mobility in the long term. We need to involve kids and their friends, make contact with neighbours and barter. We need to review what we really need and reduce consumption. And the possibility of sharing our places, taking in a lodger. There could be a campaign, a lodger, a boarder. This is what was done. All owners in the past got some additional income by having someone share the house. As well as being good for helping to pay off the mortgage, this is the most significant thing homeowners could do to improve the community and the environment. Better use of public infrastructure, better community surveillance, rebuilding the household and community economies. A serious analysis would show this is the most one of the most effective policies we could do. But it won't actually help the building industry at all. It won't help really the tax base that much. It'll build the household and community economy. And of course, there's all sorts of deep personal privacy and power issues that need to be overcome. Sharing your car, carpooling and picking up hitchhikers. Apart from the fourfold increase in fuel efficiency that this can achieve, this is actually, there's another level to this strategy, which is actually to get people talking to each other, trusting each other, these informal connections which are essential in dealing with this energy descent future to avoid the path into fear and fascism. and we need to creatively work around regulatory impediments. We can't expect to go to regulatory authorities and say, please, can we have permission to do this, when it actually isn't on the list, because all bureaucracies can do is tick boxes. No one is making any professional assessment or judgment. Even when they're paid $100,000 a year, all they can do is tick boxes. So it is often better to try and honestly and seriously look at what is responsible socially to do and connect with the other people who might be affected by what we do, because for a start, they're the source of complaints that authorities react to, and build that capacity to do things, to put the models in place, and of course always be prepared to apologise and recognise the very important job that regulators do in our society. Perhaps the last one is really the most serious one, and I think there are some very serious issues. How do we pay off debt? And I think people need to look at this very seriously, because the vulnerability of this whole system, of course, is around debt. And I think sometimes that involves the hard decisions to say, we will sell out of this house and buy a more modest house in a cheaper place. The other one that I've already mentioned is get more people helping to pay that off. Also, of course, the work from home strategy. We're not really using the capacity, the possibility to work from home that's there. So I really want to present this as a positive pathway that we can see suburbia as actually an opportunity rather than a lost cause. And I would end with the fact that we have to retrofit for the future, not speculative gain. Thank you very much.